106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
Now, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
You're drowning, and I throw you a life jacket. Would you grab it? Yes. Good. Pick up 200 shares. I won't let you down.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
Ask them how they'd like to see 30, 40% returns. What are they going to say? No? I don't want to see those returns.
Where's the money, Lebowski?
You're going to make a lot of money, right?
Be aggressive. Learn how to push.
Show him a 3% return, and I'll trust you to watch his kids for the weekend.
I'm a big fan of money.
Move around. Motion creates emotion.
I did not know this.
That's it. I'm done.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen, Burn on the board. S&P futures down 10, NASDAQ futures down 51. The last day of the quarter usually is a window dressing up day, so don't be surprised if this turns around here. Although, we have Japan down 4%, don't we, Greg? I think it's some big move over there. Of course, they have been up huge, but still.
Danger, Will Robinson.
Still, that's kind of a... They're down 1,900 points, so that's kind of a lot, but... China is still up, though, which is even crazier as they continue to expand their whatever they're expanding.
Did you see Tepper last week?
No. What did he say this time?
He was on CNBC, and he was saying the same thing that he was in 2010. Buy everything. He was talking about JD, Alibaba, all the Chinese stocks.
Yeah, well, they're going up, so you got to buy them, right?
He's been good at that.
Whatever. This morning, we're going to do a little sports here, since we have all kinds of sports going on this weekend. So Kevin has
the game of the season, Georgia Alabama.
We'll see. There's how many games of the decade do we have every week?
You get games of the decade, storms of the decade.
Well, you younger dudes see a guy with a good game.
It's games of the century that really matter, Tom.
Yeah, it's the games. How many fights of the century do we have last century? About 50.
Could have been.
Every time you see a good fight,
what do you think qualified any of the Ali Frazier's?
Yeah.
Would have been the fight of the century. Plus, if we would have said
Tyson Holyfield with the ear.
What about Ali Liston?
I don't know if that's a fight of the century. That's just a debacle of the century.
What about Ali Liston?
I don't think it was considered that at the time, though.
That's because
it's got to be. You got to talk. Got to discuss it before. Excuse me.
You have to be hyped. The journalistics. Dudes weren't as hypey back then. You got to have hype. Every storm's the worst hurricane ever. Everything's whatever.
Yeah, so, maybe Sugar Ray Leonard and Tommy Hearns might have been up there. There's a few of those kinds of events, but not that many. Not that many. So we only have a few fights of the century every century.
Before they were none of the Marciano ones, none of the Joe Louis ones. If they knew what the term,
I'm sure they were. I just I'm not old enough to remember it.
Well, we were so lame. We didn't even call the first Super Bowl Super Bowl.
That's because we didn't know it was a Super Bowl yet.
We didn't know it was just a playoff. Until it became a Super Bowl, then it was super. Just saying. So Kevin, what is this thing with baseball today? This is a. Very interesting, huh?
Doubleheader.
Yeah, and then they have to. Then the next series is 2 out of 3, right? At the other guy's home park.
So the winner, I have to see where they're gonna where they gotta travel.
San Diego. Somebody has to go to San Diego because they're in.
Could be San Diego. Could be back to Milwaukee.
One or the other. The
let's see. Let's see what the postseason schedule looks like here. If we look at the NLCS, San Diego's the 4, the 5 goes there, the 6, which is the last spot in, goes to Milwaukee. So who was just in Milwaukee? The Mets? The Mets could go to Atlanta and then turn around and go back to Milwaukee, conceivably. Or they could get shipped out to San Diego. I'm not sure how that's going to lay out for them. But what's really interesting is if the Mets and the Braves split today, then there's a three-way tie for the last spot. And I'm sure there's somebody who knows the tiebreakers for that.
I'm looking right at it. The Mets, this is what I was going to say is strange. Right now the Mets, And the Braves have an 88-72 record. They're short two games because they were hurricaned out, right, Kevin?
Yeah.
The Diamondbacks are 89-73. So they've played two more games. They've won one, lost one. If these guys split today, both of them are in, and Arizona's out, even though they would all have the same record because of the tiebreaker. So if they split, they're out, and it also means that the Mets would
Atlanta and right now as it stands, just based on winning percentage, Atlanta and New York are in and Arizona's out. So the split will get them all 549. That means there's two out of three of them are going to get are getting in. So okay, I can see how that.
Right, why don't I just read it? So it
works out for the Diamondbacks.
Three clubs battling for the two remaining wild card spots. The D-backs stayed alive with 11-2 victory over the Padres. Blah blah blah. The Mets also won, topping the Brewers 5-0. While Atlanta fell 4-2 to the Royals, which gave them the same record. Results left Arizona 89-73 record, with the Braves and Mets both at 88-72. The D-backs lose a three-way tiebreaker as well as a two-team tiebreaker to both Atlanta and New York, so they will advance only if there's a sweep in Monday's doubleheader. If the Mets and Braves split the twin bill, they would both get postseason berths. With a split, Atlanta claims a tiebreaker over New York with a 7-6 mark in the season series and a second wild card in the number 5 seed, which means they would go to the Padres. The only way the Mets can claim a number 5 seed is by sweeping the Braves. The Mets otherwise would go to Milwaukee.
So here's your interesting question. The team that wins game one is in. Do they rest their guys in game two?
I would say that if... let's see. What did I say of the two? What did I say of the tiebreaker? If Atlanta wins the first game, they can rest their people because they're in no matter what, because they have the tiebreaker. So they would have the number 5 seed if they win game one. So they could rest their people and have an outfielder pitch if they wanted to. But don't forget, they just had two games off too, so 2 days off. Yeah. So they ought to have people rested.
They got people rested, but they'd sure like to line up as much as they can for their playoff series.
Right now, whether or not
they really wouldn't want to spend, one of their rotation guys if they could help it in game two.
Well, if the Mets win, they definitely want to win a second game. Because I'm sure they'd rather play San Diego to Milwaukee, but maybe not. I don't know. I don't think you would.
Well, and so that gives a good question for the manager. Do you want to pick your opponent, or do you want... Well, San Diego's really good, though, and they're hot. And they won 93 games. So, of course, I think the Brewers are really good, too. But, San Diego was going down to the last week with a chance to win their division. And they're a 93-game winner just like the Brewers are. So, I don't know, but, do you want to pick your opponent, or do you want to line up your pitching staff? Which one's more important to you?
I don't know. Like I'm saying, given the 2 days off they had, I don't know how lined up they already aren't. One game makes that much difference. You could start your fifth starter, and you wouldn't use the playoffs anyway, instead of, a bullpen start.
Yeah, you can do like that, yes. But what you don't want to do is you don't want to go into a playoff series having a bullpen day.
No. Well, it depends on the schlumps you have in there. Now, you get an extra guy you still get an extra guy for a doubleheader, even in a playoff? On the roster?
I think you do.
But no, we don't. Now, who's the playoff rosters? No, they were set yesterday. When were they set? Well, you can change them every series now, right?
Well, I think you have to have an injury to change. I don't know. That's a good question. The rules have changed enough times.
Well, they change every year because we keep adding more games. It used to be a one-game playoff for the wild card. Now it's 2 out of 3, right?
Yep.
All right, while you're here, switch over to footsteps.
Best of three. So we have that, and then the Cubs finished with 83 wins, which is about what they were predicted to get at the start of the season. So that's kind of interesting. As much as they struggled through the middle, they wound up about where they were expected to wind up, which is baseball sort of in many ways, in that and that baseball is a game where things tend to seek their level out because they play so many games.
I'm not going to say anything nice about the Cubs, although I might here. The last 2 years, really under both managers, even though they're paying this guy a hell of a lot more, they really straightened themselves out in the second part of the season with newer people and so forth. I think that whole, they just got blindsided in the early part of the year with that closer going down, where they lost 16 save opportunities in like 3 weeks or something.
Oh yeah, it was horrible. They were contending in the middle of the season. They were contending with the White Sox for blown saves.
They had what? How many in the first half and like only four in the second half? And once they got their bullpen kind of straightened out.
Yeah, and so that, you know, that's to their credit. They still had guys that didn't hit until it was pretty much too late.
Yeah.
So, you know, so that was a problem. And it was a problem that they didn't hit all at once. You know, I mean, that's the big thing is they didn't hit all at the same time.
Well, they also they have too many people. And, I'm going to give my grumpy old guy assessment. This crap about on base, you know, whatever this, that, and the other thing, and don't bunt, don't do any of this other stuff. I think, Kevin, it's being proven to be a load of crap. You have to be able to hit the ball, or they don't walk you. Why would they walk you if you can't hit? I mean,
well, yeah, it is important to get on base.
I understand that, but a lot of that is a function of who's batting behind you. I mean,
Tom, this is why OPS versus on base percentage has become stressed more. You know, we started out, you know, in the early stats age, as they were looking at on base percentage, and that's important. But then they started looking at the on base plus the slugging, and now that's where the real value is, and that's where it's considered. So, you know, you have to get extra base hits. You have to be a good hitter. So singles are good, doubles are better. Home runs better still, but you're valuing both. You're not valuing home runs to the exclusion of getting on base.
All right, well, I guess what I'm saying is, you can't have the Cubs are short. Although since Pete Armstrong and the catcher spot have started to hit, they were short 15 hits a week. Now I think they're short five or six. There's way too many games where they have three and four hits against a good pitcher. Their stuff is padded by, if they were to get a crummy pitcher, all of a sudden they score 15 runs or something, or 12.
So, well, I mean, sure, but that's true of everybody too. So.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, they have to, if this kid Armstrong can get on base at all, he's got to lead off. He absolutely has to lead off because he can run like a deer, and he screws up the pitcher when he's on first base. I would put Horner in a second spot because he can hit behind somebody. Nobody else can. And then I would go from there. I mean, you have to have your speed at the top of the lineup. If you don't have home run, you know, a bunch of home run power hitters, you've got to find a way to manufacture runs. And you can't be station-to-station baseball with a bunch of guys hitting 250. I don't think.
Yeah. And, Tom, personally, I tend to look at doubles more than I look at home runs because there's a power consistency that goes with that. You hit a lot of doubles, you're going to hit home runs too. But you know, when you start to look at them, as an example, you know, Michael Busch hit 20. Nico Horner hit 35 doubles. That's okay with me. He only hit seven home runs, but he set himself up, especially because he can run. He set himself up to score. Quite well, because he can find the gaps, he can find the lines, he can do all of that kind of stuff. Where, you know, when I start looking at, I guess Ian Happ's the only other guy that had a lot of doubles in 34. You may remember when he was the year he played half of the year for the Cubs. What's the guy's name? Plays for the Phillies now.
Italian name, right?
Yeah, he was chasing 60 doubles. So,
well, I mean, the doubles versus home runs to me in a lot of days is which way the wind's blowing, literally, in the park you're playing it, right?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. But if you're hitting the ball, you know, there's not a lot of people who hit, you know, 35 dink doubles.
Well, I mean, so, if you ask the guys back in the 60s and 70s, that who hit the ball the hardest of anybody, you know, not as far, the guy who hit the hardest of any, virtually everybody said Al Oliver from the Pittsburgh. Said his line drives and even his ground balls were screaming. And yet he never elevated anything. But he was an unbelievable doubles hitter, and he's a guy you really wanted on your team. And you didn't want to play infield with that guy hitting. But he was a... Billy Williams is sort of the same way. He was just a racket hitter and someone out, right?
Yeah. Even his home runs, of which there were way more than 400, Billy Williams would hit a lot of line drives. They probably wouldn't... he could hit it out into the street sometimes, but Billy Williams was more likely to hit one into the fifth row than he was anywhere else.
I read this thing, and I could find it somewhere.
And you know what? No style points, so it only counts for one, no matter how far you hit it, as long as it makes it over the fence.
I was actually reading, of course, there's one thing about this wacky Core Digest is there's people, obviously, have nothing to do. There is a guy who represents himself as the encyclopedia of long home runs, where he went out, where everybody had his 500-foot home run, his 600-foot home run, all this kind of stuff, where he went out and actually he researched where the thing landed and whether or not it was on the bounce or whatever. And, you know, the idea of Babe Ruth had the 600-foot shot in the exhibition game or something. He actually went out there, and the place is now a racetrack and wasn't a ballpark, but he located where the home base was and where the thing allegedly landed, and he goes it was more like 510 or 520. But he claims there's only been like 15 or 20 500-foot home runs in all of baseball, and only like five people hit them. Babe Ruth had like 11 of them. Mickey Mantle had a few. Was it Mark McGwire had one or two, and maybe Sosa had one, or Kingman or somebody. There weren't very many. I mean, and they're like five guys that hit like all of them, according to him. And, you know, wouldn't surprise me. You know, Kevin, did you ever go watch these guys in spring training? I used to go out. This is before there was a zillion people at spring training. I'd go out where the Cubs played back when I was younger, and they had all these soccer fields. So I'd run my sprints on the soccer fields when I was in good shape, and I'd go over to Fitch Field and watch the minor leaguers play. And if anybody hasn't seen a bunch of baseball people working out at the same time, it's absolute choreography. They've got guys they're pitching to in a batting cage, and the third baseman will have a screen in front of him, and so will the pitcher, so will the first baseman. Meanwhile, in the left, the little circle you see on the field, you wonder what that's for? That's for guys to hit batting practice. So on the left side, the guy's hitting ground balls to short and second, or if the batter hits it, they field it, and they wing it over to first. And the guy on the right is hitting fly balls to the outfield. There's got to be 30 people on the field, all doing practice at the same time. And all of a sudden, you'll see a guy up there, and there's 20 guys in the outfield snagging flies, and they're 15 feet in front of the warning track. Another guy comes up, all of a sudden they all turn around and walk back 15 feet. All of a sudden when it comes off his bat, it sounds just different, Kevin. Then another guy comes up and they're all standing on a warning track. It is amazing that some people have the bat speed and some don't. I mean, you could just, it's like in softball.
Well, it is bat speed, but it's also strength. There's a big strength in the forearms, because the physics of it is, this is just really basic stuff too, is when the ball hits the bat, there's a certain amount of recoil, you know, where the bat doesn't just blow right through and turn the ball into mush. There's a certain amount of recoil. That's based on a recoil, and that's based on how much strength you have. So as you swing through the ball, are you stronger than the pitcher's, you know, than the pitcher's throwing? And, you know, if you were to have this really super slow-mo, you would see that the bat is, you know, the bat's progress is slightly impeded when it hits the ball.
Well, sure it is. I'll get you.
Strongest guys, less impeded.
Well, I remember, you know, pitching batting practice in softball. Most of the time, the pitcher, you stand there and you got eight balls in your hand and you're just winging one in. Figured if somebody hit it back at you, you'd get it out of the way. But there were Big Mike and Russell and a couple people, I'd drop all the rest of the balls, because if he hit one back at me, I'd better be ready. You know, big difference. In the speed of some of these guys. I mean, you there were guys that have, most of the time in softball when you're hitting the balls, the infielders don't have a problem turning around and getting the ball from the outfield. But a couple of guys hitting, you wouldn't turn around, right, Kevin? Because if you got clipped, you left the mark.
Yeah.
But there weren't very many. Out of 100 guys, it's probably like four guys hit the ball that hard, right?
That sounds about right.
Yeah. I mean, it's just anyway, so we have the football, nothing crazy in the NFL yet. Everybody is tell you what, the hardest thing in the world is, I think, Kevin, is to play a good team like the Ravens or somebody that somehow starts out 0-2 or 1-2 or something. You know, they can do everything they possibly can to not drain themselves for the whole season. It really is not who you play, it's when you play them, right?
Well, yeah, because I think the Bears caught the Rams with some guys down. Of course, you know, anybody who wants to defend the Bears right now, and I'm not talking about Caleb Williams, I'm talking about their ability to block people. Offensive lines can get their act together. Even if they're not good, they can just stop whiffing on blocks, you know, so that they're at least in the way. So a little bit of teamwork, a little bit of choreography in there, and that'll work out okay. But right now, they've got guys missing a lot of assignments. So even though the Bears won yesterday, which is good, and I'm very happy about it, they had two chances to ice the game by getting the ball late in the game and not giving it back, and they just couldn't block anything to make that happen.
Plus, Caleb Williams, thank God he's not hurt already. It's like a jailbreak every play.
Yeah, he's been doing it. What's interesting about it is that last week, Caleb Williams had 363 yards passing and two touchdowns and two interceptions. What do you think his quarterback rating was? I'm not going to ask you to give the answer. It was 80.8. This week, he was 17 out of 23. So he threw the ball less, very high percentage, and he had a touchdown and no interceptions. His quarterback rating was 106.6, which is pretty darn good.
Did you see the Kansas City game where Mahomes took out his end? His receiver?
You know, I didn't see that play. I heard something about it on it this morning, but yeah.
Well, two things.
But
one
the
is
Bears, he... the Bears got DeAndre Swift going a little bit, which was good. And if you look down their catches, they got three to Komet, three to DJ Moore, and three to Keenan Allen. So you know they're starting to use those weapons a little bit better, but they still. That's really the weakness of their team is their offensive line is it's not the worst that you know the lowest rated part of their team. It's a weakness. It's an out and out weakness, and that's pretty hard to address at this point, other than to just say you guys have to get your assignments right. If you don't at least get in the other guy's way, we're going to have a very very long season.
Well, there was a rule. We'll run here over a second. In that scramble where the guy got hurt in Kansas City, what I'm talking about is Mahomes throws this interception. The guy runs down the sidelines. They hit him, and the ball flies out of his hand. Now, and everybody goes to scramble for the ball. And what Mahomes was doing over there, I have no idea. But he hurls his body into the thing, and he whacks into his wide receiver's knee, hyperextends it. But the interesting part, Kevin, a rule that I didn't know, my nephew was telling me last night, Kansas City recovers the ball. And upon further review, they give it to the Chargers. And I'm going, turns out one of the Charger guys is out of bounds. Now, the ball's laying maybe 2 feet in from the sideline. The guy reaches over from out of bounds and puts his hand on it, and then the Kansas City guy falls on it. Evidently, if the team who fumbled the ball, which is the Chargers, fumbles the ball out of bounds, which essentially this guy being out of bounds and putting his hand on it, if you fumble the ball out of bounds, it's yours. So that was considered fumbling it out of bounds, even though the ball stayed in play. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that is kind of interesting. Oh, because of electricity.
Or something. But I mean, but he was out of bounds, reached over and tried to grab it, and had his hand on it, and then the Kansas City guy jumped on it. But since he was considered out of bounds, it was like the ball was out of bounds,
yeah,
too.
I did know that, and it makes sense to me. All right, one more most bizarre, and I'll turn you over to John. The most bizarre play of the weekend was the play in the Notre Dame-Louisville game where both the receiver and the defender that called for pass interference, and it wasn't because of what one guy did 3 seconds before the other guy did it. It was they both got called for pass interference, offsetting penalties, going after the ball.
Really?
Yes. Very interesting.
Well, Ryan Harris, who's a color guy, said that should be called. A lot of times when they call pass interference on one or the other, on a replay, the other guy had already nailed the other dude, and the other, that a lot of times they both commit pass interference on the same play.
And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. So it just they just did it down over then, right?
Yeah, so they just replayed the down.
That's sort of interesting. Wow. All right, bud. Are you back? You're still in Nashville?
I am. I just got here yesterday, so yeah, I'm still here. I will be. I'll talk to you Wednesday morning from here, and then I will head north. I have a class via Zoom at 1 o'clock, so I'm gonna see if I can make it to Indianapolis and teach my class by 1, so that I don't have to get home at midnight. Otherwise, I'll be teaching it from Sellersburg.
Oh God.
Sellersburg is in southern Indiana.
Well, how did Nashville make out with all this rain? Because North Carolina got inundated.
Well, I drove through a lot of scattered showers yesterday. So everything looks fine here. I walked over, walked around the resort, et cetera. So it seems like everything was okay, but I haven't talked to anybody about how much rain they got.
All right, SP Futures down 11, NASDAQ Futures down 61. Thank you, Kevin. Be right back, Mr. John Flanagan and Greg Pappas.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to factor in the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other life decision. Your brain is smarter than your gut, and that's why you owe it to yourself to read Luckbox. We've made it easy because Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with timely, actionable trading ideas, and equips you with savvy investing tactics you don't already know, all while exploring how to live your best life through music, spirits, food, sports, travel, fitness, and a whole lot more. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on controlling their financial futures. It's for overachievers and alpha types who don't buy into Wall Street's investment gurus. It's for mavericks who believe in life, luxury, and the pursuit of happiness. It's for you. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. As you all know, the broad markets, especially tech, have been hot for a while. Lots of reasons. New technology, small fixed income returns, a lot of Fed cash, maybe some good management. Recently, however, the rates on fixed income investments, even U.S. Treasury, have risen from the very low levels. Treasuries are more attractive. There might even be some interesting bonds out there. Also, the bull run has some leading stocks with historically high valuations, maybe making long-only positions a little riskier. So what to do? I think the answer is flexibility. The market may keep going higher. It may not. It could even go down. Is fixed income a thought for some part of the portfolio? Rates are not zero anymore. You may want to protect some gains. Think about some rebalancing, address some growing concentration issues, maybe thinking about commodities. We at PTI may have a solution just right for you. Open an account at PTI Pro Direct, PTI's online trading platform using the interactive broker high-end platform.
There you will find competitive rates and solid execution across all product lines and traditionally high interest on money balances. In addition, at any time you can seamlessly decide for fixed income investments to access Dan Janitas at Kratos Capital for management services. Dan and his team work tirelessly to achieve the highest returns they can, whatever risk category you are comfortable with. You can also quickly access my team for investment services and a wide array of investment strategies on the security or commodity side, protective strategies, concentration issues, or straight long. In one place, you'll be able to be flexible and ride whatever the future market holds with people you are used to hearing and trusting every day. Need help? You got it. Don't need help? That's okay, too. You'll have a great self-management platform with help always available. This market can change on a dime. I believe, like everyone else, having the right people there if needed is the way to go. Call me at 312-663-4310 or email me at time@ptisecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right
now. Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allman, front of the board. S&P futures down 15. NASDAQ futures down 78. Dow futures down 62. So we're down a little bit, but not much. Kind of surprising on the last day of the quarter. You would think we want to give it one more little goose here. But maybe it may turn out that way. However, we got some negative figures elsewhere. We got the DAX down 121.6%, FTSE down 63.7, back around down 127. That's a full 1.6%. That's a big move in the Kakaron. Auto stocks are down about 4% across the board. Friday, Dow was up 137, S&P down 7, NASDAQ down 70. It's kind of a mixed day. Over in Asia, this is interesting this morning. Nikkei down 1,900, down 4.8%. China, the best day of trading since 2008 because of the stimulus rally. So I don't know what maybe we're just redefining their currency or something, but Hang Seng's up 501, that's 2.4%. 21,000, these guys were hacking around 18,000 about a few days ago. Shanghai up 248, that's the biggest move I think I've ever seen there, that's 8%. 3,300, looking like the Weimar Republic or like Argentina or someplace. I know we've got everybody on TV talking about how you should have bought stuff over in China. I don't know about that. 10-year up 2 basis points, 3.77. The Bund unchanged, 2.14. Japan up 5 basis points, 0.86. Maybe that's part of it. Oil, down 53 cents, 67.65. So right back down to these lows. After running up, everybody's worried about the Saudis. Well, get up to 72, now it's right back down. Brent down 61 cents, 71.37. Natural gas unchanged, 290. RBOB unchanged, 195. Gold down 720, a little bit of a pullback, but not much, still 26.60. Silver down 34 cents, 31.47. Copper down 3 cents, 4.56. Foreign exchange, the Bureau is right about 112 where it has been. British pound, however, is up to 134. So the dollar is still a little weak. Against the yen is at 142.46. Bitcoin down 2,200. It was really high, but it's still 63,653. But it's still a 3.5% move today. So some stuff's moving. What do you have for us, Trevor? Weather, sports, man.
Yeah. Good morning, everyone. It's currently 6:42 a.m. on September 30th, 2024. Weather in Chicago is currently 62 degrees at O'Hare with a high of 79 today. Mostly sunny skies with little cloud coverage tonight. Cloudy with a low of 60. Down in Phoenix, 86 degrees right now. Later in the day, mostly sunny and very hot with a high of 107 degrees. In the MLB yesterday, White Sox won against Detroit Tigers 9-5. The Cubs lost against Cincinnati Reds 3-0. And in the NFL yesterday, Bears won their second game of the season in their game against the Rams. Final score was 24-18. Packers, though, lost to Vikings 31-29. Vikings are currently leading the NFC in total wins 4-0. So I got Chief, back to you.
Mr. Greg, where did the... hey, John. Greg, where did the Vikings become this juggernaut all of a sudden?
Which ones?
The Vikings. They're winning every game except for yesterday by like 30 points. What got into them?
It was impressive. Watched most of that.
Are they that good?
Hats off. And actually, the Packers, they got it together, too, halfway through the game. So,
all of a sudden, the Bears went from, like, the worst division to the best. Almost, right?
It's good for us. Mm. And good, I mean, football fans. Yeah, not, well, you know.
If they lose all six against those guys, it's not good for the Bears.
Well, nothing's changing there. We know that.
That's true. just saying, hey, Jan, what's up? How was your Monday?
So far, so good. I got a dental appointment. That's always a great thing for a Monday. So,
you know, just saying.
You get to be a certain age, you dread these things, you know?
Oh, I know. It's, you know, whatever. I go every 3 months for the cleaning, and you absorb that for a half hour, and you're happy to get out of there. So, it's, anywho. Hey, I got a question. I was doing some, seems like everywhere you go, it's like I'm a Stacks and Jacks Cub reporter. Greg knows a gentleman I was out with breakfast with on Saturday. I have mentioned before, I still go out. There used to be a barber shop in the CBOE building. And, of course, that's shuttered and gone. So the guy moved out to Westchester. So whenever I need a haircut, I go out to Westchester. And he's nice enough to see me at 7:30 or 8 o'clock on a Sunday, Saturday morning, since I'm up early. Find out all the stuff the other guys go out there, who's doing what with who. Well, anyway, one of my friends and a client, I said, hey, if you're out, he says, if you're out this way, call me. I'm up early. We'll go for breakfast. So we go to breakfast in this place in Berkeley, Illinois. You guys even hear of that? I never have. It's on Wolf Road in like St. Charles. I know nothing about the West Side. I admit to being a total loser when it comes to West Side geography. Driving through this little town, and it's kind of, what would you call it, John? Lower to middle class town from the days.
Yeah, like post World War II houses.
Yeah, and you see a couple of factories that look like they're closed, and a couple that are open, and you know, I pull into this really nice little breakfast place, and I walk in, and they look at me like, "Who the hell is this guy?" There can't be five people in the place at 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and I'm going, "This area ain't doing so hot, Lucy." Sit down, start, you know, talking to the guy. My buddy comes in, and we had a really nice breakfast and all this kind of stuff, and all of a sudden I'm real curious about the area. So of course I get back on the Eisenhower, and there's construction, and then there's a big crack up where the construction was. You ain't going nowhere in the Eisenhower. So I get off, figure, all right, I'll take the city route in, which I haven't done in a long time. It's early enough, I probably won't get shot. The shooters are still sleeping. So I get on Washington Boulevard for a while, and I go through at Lake Street, go through Oak Park. Oak Park's a happening place. You know, everybody's lining up for the soccer games and the football games and everything, and you can see Oak Park is bustling. Go through Maywood. I think you go through Maywood a little, John. And that section of Maywood seemed pretty nice. I mean, not horrible.
Yeah, it's really, you know, old prairie style houses. And,
yeah.
Very, very good housing stock.
But then once you get past Harlem, you end up on essentially the city Lake Street. Guys, I've never seen that kind of, there's nothing there. It's like your own personal street. Maybe there's like one or two other cars. I think this is where you're underneath the L tracks. Well, in the city, the L tracks, the supports go from sidewalk to sidewalk, so you got a lot of room. Out there, they don't. They're just two lanes wide, so you got to be real careful. If another car's coming your way, you better be further away, or you got to whack into one of the poles. It must have been 3 miles, guys. I didn't see. I don't think there was a business on either side. It's just leveled. It's just ground stone on either side of the street. You look over, you see houses. You know, houses like every other house is knocked down. It's like the South Side. I had no idea that there hasn't been anything there in how many years, Jen? 2-3 decades?
Oh, since I was in the 60s, 70s, when the business days, you know, there's a lot of light industry. There's a couple shells of buildings still left along there, but it's really, you know, it's come down really since the 70s, I think, was the biggest exodus. Occasionally, I go out to the Garfield Park Conservatory. You probably drove past that.
Right by the, you drive by the northern edge of Garfield Park on Lake Street.
Yeah, and the glass, you know, the Jens Jensen, it's one of the largest indoor, you know, glass conservatories for plant life and so on in the world. And they moved a defunct station on the Lake Street L to that corner at Central Park Avenue at Lake Street where the Garfield Park Conservatory is. They renamed this, you know, 1890s vintage restored L stop, called it's now the Conservatory Station. And I've taken
the L there. That was pretty cool. I wonder what that was.
Yeah, it's beautiful. But, you know, around there, I mean, the conservatory is spectacular.
How far do you got to walk from the L station to conservatory?
Well, it's right there. Oh. It's maybe 200 feet, So it's, and I don't do it at night, but the conservatory is open, you know, all sorts of hours, and it's an amazing place. But you drive around the neighborhood, as I have when I've got rental cars, and I'm just, you know, astounded at how deserted and depopulated the area is. And the park itself is beautiful. You know, it's just one of the showpieces of park design. But I don't know, you know, really who wants to utilize it or who can walk to it, because there's so little residential housing stock left in that area.
It's like, I didn't realize, I mean, you hear about the west side all the time. It's as bad as the south side.
Yeah, you know, my mom worked on the west side before and after she was married for, you know, a furniture manufacturer, and she tells stories about, you know, starting to commute there from the south side to the west side. It was like around, you know, Harrison Street and California, which is an old Italian neighborhood at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And as she said, after the war, it became all like, you know, Appalachians, Southerners that moved up, and Italians moved elsewhere. And then it became, you know, more African-American. And then it just became, you know, it just lost population dramatically fast. And she, you know, it was kind of like her adopted neighborhood because she spent a lot of time there. But she just thought it was kind of like, what's next for a place like this? I mean, it doesn't seem like it's ever too stable. And it had a lot of old charm and restaurants and stuff, but it was just gradually becoming depopulated.
Well, you mentioned that, John, because my grandmother, you know, I was there all the time when my dad died and so forth. My grandmother lived at 60th and Wallace, 62nd and Wallace, right behind the Southtown Theater. And the neighborhood went from white to black, it seemed, and they didn't move. So they were just one of the few white families that was still left. And grandmother always talked about, everybody blamed the decimation of the neighborhood on the black people. My grandmother was always very quick to point out that what you just mentioned, there was a in-between group. It's not politically correct, but she would refer to them, since she's been dead for how many years, referred to them as the Hillbillies.
Yeah.
And so they're the people that cut up the apartments from one, you know, one apartment into two, and essentially made the neighborhood so that people wanted to leave. And then the blacks essentially moved in after that. But the interim move was, I use the term white trash, which is, you know, it's not the right term. But in fact, there was an economic degradation to the neighborhood that happened before the black people moved in, and it was blamed on the black people. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, and, you know, the same thing happened in several south side neighborhoods over along the lake where both of my parents, you know, lived. And the war, I think, had a lot to do with it, because, and the Depression had more to do with it, because people migrated to the north, just as the African Americans had migrated during World War One to get jobs during the height of Jim Crow in the 30s.
Well, that was really the Great Migration. That was the Great Migration. It came up on the city of New Orleans, basically. I mean, that's why it was America's railroad. It came up on the city of New Orleans.
But, you know, there was a similar one in the 30s among people who were really flat on their backs in the rural South and even the urban South when, you know, factories closed, you know, businesses went under, people were evicted from homes and farms and everything. And there was a huge influx. You can see it in the census records when I've gone back and done genealogical, you know, research. But, you know, people from Alabama, Kentucky, you know, they were not living there in the 1930 census, and in the 1940 census, they're everywhere in the neighborhood. And you can tell that they're, you know, combining living arrangements so that there's, you know, subdivided apartments, homes that were split up. And that wasn't just, you know, a phenomenon in Chicago or on the South Side or any place else in the Depression, but it did kind of set these neighborhoods up for, especially the aging neighborhoods, for further degrading. When, you know, they were already like overly occupied, and then, you know, those people moved on after the war, and the next wave was, you know, the ones who were probably lowest on the totem pole, economically speaking, who couldn't buy property, couldn't get mortgages, right, couldn't get insurance or anything else, So they were the next rung, and but they were poised in a way. The neighborhoods were poised for just another step down the financial ladder, where you couldn't attract people with your better earning power. So
when you start talking, it's 8 to 10 people in an apartment was not unheard of.
Oh no, no, and the Depression was commonplace.
Well, no, the point is, and I want a younger guy's opinion here. I mean, Greg. So I see this on a Saturday, all right. So yesterday, do my Sunday thing over my bros who loves to cook. you guys want to go over there on a day where softball's rained out? Because he has like 7 or 8 entrees for 7 or 8 people. He just loves to cook. It's, you know, I love to cook too, but he's got a lot of energy. So plus he's had a bumper crop of zucchini in his garden. So we have stuffed zucchini, zucchini casserole, or long zucchini, which is very healthy, obviously. And anyway, so my nephew's telling me that they're metal. They have a metals. What do you call a metal place that pretty much makes parts for other people and conveyors and stuff? They don't make specific machines, but they make. If your Tootsie Roll and your conveyor goes out, they'll make the parts for the conveyor so you can fix it. They fabricate things that just people need. Bring them a drawing, bring them a part. They'll make the drawing, they'll make the part. They're a metal service company, I guess that's if you want to call it, right, Jen? And they have machines that can do all that, or have individual people that can do all that. All of a sudden, well, they've been busy for a while, but all of a sudden they're like really getting busy because a lot of the factories now are doing a little better here, and they find out that sort of stuff is 50 years old and is good for another 10 years if they just maintain it. All of a sudden, there's parts they need all over the place, so there is some push here a little bit. But now I'm going to ask Greg, how do you get from some little push to the city needs probably 200,000 jobs for these neighborhoods? These are massive areas. We're talking not just a couple of blocks. We're talking square miles of what used to be houses. You know, 50 of them on a block, and now there's 10. I mean, we're talking about massive cityscape here. Some cities, I think like Akron and other places, have just said, screw it, and they've taken whole neighborhoods and just bulldozed them and turned them into parks and maybe even golf courses where they don't have to have sewer and water and lights and stuff and just cut down on the cost. I don't think we're ready to do that here. What kind of manufacturing do you need to get here to where all these little shops just pop up, and you get to the part where Kevin's always talking about, where smaller firms, which have, you know, individual people making the decision, they're a lot quicker and sprightlier than a big company, and that's where the jobs are. I've always thought, I'd love to see, this is my screwed up background, I'd like to see Chicago become the center of rail car manufacturing, passenger car, because it, you know, it's funny, Jen, we argue about electrification and using more stuff, but we don't do anything. You would think that in Chicago there would be 5 or 6, we're going crazy for these bikeways. You'd think there'd be 5 or 6 streets, especially in these areas where there's all kinds of room, to where you had a streetcar, electrically powered, right next to a big bike lane. You either get on a streetcar or you can ride your bike. I mean, because you can put streetcars, what do you need? The thing has to be 10 feet wide, right? And you can have how many people on that thing?
We're the flattest city, except for, you know, a few neighborhoods in the world.
Yeah, I mean, have you ever gone to Amsterdam, their main drag where all the shops are, in the middle of the street, they have 2 streetcar tracks, but what's the word for it, Jen? They're Gantley tracks, is that the term? I bet you or Greg even know what that means.
You mean the power source? Or
the track itself. What happens is, and they had one of these on the bridge. Remember when they had the accident on the bridge of the South Shore? You look down at the railroad track in the middle of essentially the sidewalk. The car comes through there slow because it's all pedestrians, but it's right in the middle of where all the shopping is. It comes down the middle at 3 miles an hour, drops people off, and then heads off. But the track looks like it's only one track, but if you look twice, there's 4 rails. So there's actually 2 lines. But when they come in, they don't, they're not next to each other. They're combined. But you don't have to switch from one to the other. When the train comes in, or the train, when the streetcar comes in from the one side, it'll be on the outside right, inside left. It gets to the end and it goes off. Then one comes the other way, and it'll be on the inside right, outside left. They never leave the rail, but they end up.
Oh, right, yeah, they loop the M.
Yeah, so and you can have all kinds of people on these things. If they're long enough, you can put 100 people on them. They pile out, they do their shopping, they hop right back on, they go home. I mean, it's an incredible way to move people. And here we keep doing this bike stuff on a street where there's cars. Why don't we just take a couple of streets and say these are bikes and streetcars only? Well, you know, going one way, going north, you get down the street. You know, going back downtown, you get down another street, a block away. There's all kinds of things we could do if we actually thought outside the box instead of just talking about stuff.
Well, I haven't been in Amsterdam in many years, but I was amazed in riding the streetcars there that everything was on the honor system. You know, you paid your fare, but there's nobody there ready to throw you off if you didn't pay your fare. So I thought they were light years ahead of us or behind us. I'm not sure which. But I would like to see some saner approach to, you know, mingling bikes and automobiles. And there's a piece of the Sun Times the other day, you know, how to adjust the imbalance between the bicycles and cars. And I thought the only thing left out of the article which concerned me the most were pedestrians. Because
most of the
streets that I, you know, around my neighborhood that have had bike lanes installed in them now, nobody uses them. No bikers use them because the traffic is so constrained because of the bike paths. The cars are in a hurry. They're always delayed. So they're trying to get around somebody or something. And it's not good for bikes to be competing with that.
Not well thought out.
So they ride
on
the sidewalk.
It's not well thought out.
Yeah, the Lawrence Avenue sidewalks are about the narrowest I can.
Well, when you leave downtown, here, and I haven't been up there, but I don't think that the Northwestern, I'll bet there's room on that superstructure for a bike path. So right now, if you get to the 66 trail, you got to make it to Ashland and Armitage before you can hop on the 6 trail. The 6 trail is an old railroad right away going west. Okay, so, but you can connect to that right away from the Northwestern tracks, because that's where that train track used to meet up with, was the Northwesterns, right? So yep. you would think that you would have a spot downtown where you could get up onto those, to the, that superstructure, and there'd be a 50-foot spot for bikes next to the train tracks with a little fence, and you could go all the way from downtown to the 66 rail without having to be on a city street. You would think. Does anybody even think of stuff like that?
No. And they also don't think about weather factors. You know, a lot of the cities in Europe that, you know, have, you know, invested in, you know, bike usage don't have winters like we do. They don't have the snow or the cold. I just don't see it ever being, you know, realistic for a lot of people to use their bikes 12 months out of the year in Chicago to commute to work.
Well, not to mention, how do you plow that street? Put all that stuff
on. Of course. And then I think we don't have enough money to clear the streets. We're going to clear the bike paths now.
Well, what I'm trying to get here is not so much imagining things, but the point is, if we had you need more than one, but if you had some place that had 200-300 people making various types of railroad cars and retrofitting them, because every 20 years you got to redo the car. If you had to build a business like that, say with 200-300 people between the time the cars you're retrofitting and the cars you're making, I have to believe, John, that you have at least that many outside of there, that all of a sudden somebody's going to look at some spot on Lake Street and go, holy bleep, I can get this piece of property for nothing, and it's right near an L stop, and I can put a metal stamping plant up here, and I can ship my stuff over to wherever this rail car plant is, and my people can get here by L in the morning for, you know, a couple of bucks each way. That's what the city's supposed to be doing. If you don't have these drivers, you don't get anywhere. I mean, it's like downtown. Why can't we be, a couple of these buildings, be high-tech for the medical industry like Boston, and bring in, you know, 30,000 people to work in that? You have to have some sort of sense other than just raising taxes for the people you think got money and just driving the people the hell out of here. I mean, it's, you know, I'll give you an example of how screwed up this is. How many people, Jan, we've argued about on the show forever, you know, Greg piles in on this every once in a while, this electric stuff. Okay, we're going to, it's been a long, long time since I was at Pullman. I'm going to say 40 years. The cars that I worked on were the Massachusetts Bay. They were the first replacement commuter cars in like 50 years. The other ones, there were spots in the floor where you put your foot through before they decided they needed a new car. Well, we ended up, we at Pullman, the car we essentially, well, our guys were such dummies, not dummies individually, but the guys who estimated the car, get a load of this for a bleep up. They essentially bid the car that Pullman had, single level push-pull commuter car. So it's essentially the Rock Island Northwestern cars, but they're single level because there's a couple of tunnels they go through that you can't go through with a bigger car. Anyway, so they were going to build the same car as the Erie Lackawanna car. But in the meantime was that IC crash. Remember when the one car tunneled through the other one, all those people got killed?
Oh, October 72.
Yeah. And so in the meantime, the people who design, who make the specs for railroad cars say you need these collision posts that are much sturdier than they used to be. So that will never happen. A car will never tunnel into another car. So, which means you had to redesign the end of the car. Well, if you know anything about railroad cars, 70% of the design is in the end of the cars. So to say you weren't going to have to redesign the car, Pullman essentially signed up for that. Well, it turns out you did. Anyway, but the other thing that MBTA wanted is they wanted the car outfitted for, because they were going to electrify the rails, which is actually a really good idea. So we beefed up the roof of the car so that you could put a pantograph up there, which is the thing that reaches up like the IC cars. That's called a pantograph, if you didn't know that. We put all the wire raceways in the side of the car down to the cab and down to the trucks. So we modified the trucks where all you had to do, essentially the holes were there. You could hang the electric motors probably in a couple days, hook it up to the stuff, and you could have electrified those things, I'll say, in a week. And I'm retiring them, John. They're still not electrified. How many years ago was that? This idea is 40-some years old. They still didn't do it. Never. And nothing is nicer than an electric railroad car. It's quiet. It's fast. Faster. And by the way, you're not belching diesel, right?
Remember in 1979, the Rock Island, which was not yet part of the RTA system. Metra hadn't been formed yet. But they experimented with an Italian-made, made by Fiat.
Yeah.
Electric, you know, coaches. Each one was, you know, separately motorized. It was the same sort of idea in melt, you know, train, where they've got individual motors and they're coordinated, so their braking and everything can happen over the entire length of the train, and you don't have some derailing or speeding up or breaking apart. And it was this little Toonerville trolley, they called it, you know. But I thought this was great. It was extremely comfortable. It was very quiet. They didn't have it as part of a longer train system. It was just one single car, and they had it in kind of an odd time on the schedule so that it wouldn't be overwhelmed. But that was one of the only things that got through in the 79 Blizzard. The other ones, they couldn't get the locomotives out of the, you know, yards to get the trains hooked up. So this little Toonerville trolley.
I think those were battery powered, though. There wasn't a wire.
No, there were battery powered. That's correct. They didn't have any kind of, you know, pantograph or a trolley line attached to it, which is even better. You know, one less thing to maintain. And I thought, gee, this is a great prototype. And everybody say, thank God, you know, they ran this train, because otherwise I would have had to find out.
Well, the idea of that was, instead of having a train every hour, you could run one of those things every 15 minutes.
Right.
But
and you could hold to schedules better because there's less, you know, lead time than getting the locomotive ripped off. It still is like that, you know. It's considerable time that's spent even today that electric, you know, electricity.
Well, okay, but don't really have to break. I guess what I'm saying, Jenny, is this is not about, you know, trains, although people know what I'd love to talk about it. It's not about trains. It's about vision. And if you have a, you know, what is it going to take? I mean, my my ride on Saturday, I essentially, you know, I'm on the south side all the time. Essentially, the city needs whatever I thought they needed on the south side. Now they need double that, which is that's essentially the whole crux of where we're going with this.
Well, there's so many missed opportunities, Tom. I mean, I completely agree with the idea that, you know, all this unutilized land, you could have light industry or factories. They got transportation systems right there. But I don't think there's too many people who want a chance getting on or off transportation in those neighborhoods at 6 in the morning.
Well, and I mean, that would all be part of it. I mean let's make a real quick break here, John, and we'll come back. SPV is down 11, NASDAQ is down 59. We're gonna take like a real quick break. We'll be right back because it's not about it. It's what are we gonna do? We need the tax base turned around, countrywide, citywide. This all starts from the bottom, in my mind. There's other people talk on TV about starting from the top. You know what? They're not doing so hot, are they? But you got to start from the bottom. Somebody's got to get a job someplace, and then if they have a little bit of stuff going, who supplies them? Is that more jobs? You need to start from the bottom, I think. But question: How do you take a city like ours, which is in crumbling disrepair in most areas, how do you turn the bus around and have 200,000 good jobs, which means another 400,000 service them, which means that's, you know, 600, well, two people in the family work now, that's 300,000 families, which means you need 300,000 houses or remodeled places, and all of a sudden you're off to the races. And by the way, you got to make it so that people aren't shooting all people all the time. But how do you get from point A to point B? How do you start it? And we'll be right back. We'll talk a little bit more about that.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
What in the wide, wide world of sports is going on?
Riding on the city of New Orleans. Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm somehow Matt Byrne on the board. The very perceptive Matt Byrne. We have Greg Pappas in studio. It must be trading over there. He's kind of quiet. Anyway, Mr. John Flanagan. S&P futures down 13. NASDAQ futures down 65. And by the way, you know what? You also need to dig up, Matt, for our last break. You need to dig up the Shades of Bobby McGee. It was written by Chris Christopherson just died, right? Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah, RIP, Chris Christopherson. But the backstory, John probably knows this. I don't know if Greg does. There used to be a tremendous music spot, club, whatever you want to call it, called The Quiet Night and Sheridan and Belmont. And upstairs, now there's like a bunch of tattoo parlors in there. What a great thing that is. But I used to go there and watch, I went there with you a couple times, didn't I, Jen?
I remember.
I remember one time we went with Blade and Dave Murphy and those guys there in town. Mm. What did we see? We saw we see Siegel Schwal that night?
Well, they appeared there, right? I guess that Bonnie Pollock there. I'm trying to think when that was, and it was cheap, first class entertainment.
Yeah, was it like a couple bucks to get in, and it was no drink minimum, but they had a nice bar. They didn't need a minimum for us, did they?
It was so easy to get to.
We blew through the minimum pretty quick, as I recall. But kind of two stories. One night we were in there, and I think I wasn't with you guys. I was with my buddies from the South Side, and this band is like really good. And I go, hey, who the hell are these guys? The waitress goes, well, you'll know them tomorrow. Was the night before Summer Breeze came out. It was Seals and Croft. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, these guys are pretty good. I guess I was pretty perceptive. But that was the guy. I forgot the guy's name or owned the place. I mean, he's long dead, but the guy, the guy who died of cancer, what the hell's his name? Rode Go Cubs, Steve Goodman.
Oh, Steve Goodman. Mm.
Well, Steve Goodman, Matt, and Greg wrote the City of New Orleans.
Yeah.
And but he's, you know, he was a singer, but he wasn't a very good singer. And he was just okay. Well, Arlo Guthrie was performing there one night, and the owner says to Goodman, says, "Look, if you want this song to be a hit, which it will be, not when you sing it, let this guy sing it."
Mm.
So I don't know what the deal was, but he sold it to him, or he got some kind of the royalties or something. But he essentially gave the song, transferred the song, I'm sure Gabe wasn't part of it, to Arlo Guthrie. And the next thing you know, it's a huge hit.
Oh, yeah.
But it was written by Steve Goodman.
Huh.
But if you read the words of the song, it's really complex, right? I mean, it's not like a three-liner at all. I mean, it's to sing that song all the way through, you got to do some memory.
Very poetic, you know, great imagery. I always loved the song, and I saw Steve Goodman a couple of times, you know, towards the end of his life. I'm so glad I got to see him perform.
Well, we're going to ask
great song.
We're going to ask Greg Pappas a question here, since he's quiet. Steve Goodman had his ashes spread at home plate in Wrigley Field after he died of cancer.
Mm.
So now the next year, Wrigley Field had, you know, come into disrepair in terms of drainage and all that other kind of stuff. So they hired the sod father, the guy from Sox Park. Remember, John? He came over and tore up the entire field and you know, put all new drainage and all that other kind of stuff that now Wrigley drains. It's state of the art. So Steve Goodman's ashes are now like in a landfill somewhere. What do you think of that?
Well, that's progress, I guess, Tom.
I don't think I want to be in a landfill. Just saying.
No.
Anyway,
any place but a landfill.
Any place but a landfill. All right. I mean,
I don't think Steve Goodman wants to be in a landfill.
No. No, I mean, he's, hey, what, can't
they didn't put him into the...
Let me out of here.
They didn't put him into the concrete, or they just scattered it on the field.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he's not a landfill. He's...
He's where?
Dissolved in...
He's up in the, you know, out in the bleachers.
Well, they scooped up all the other old dirt, dumped it in a dump truck, and hauled it away and dumped it in a landfill. So that's
hard
where it
to
is.
Contain a big spirit. Like,
I'm just saying, you know. Anyway, but Jan, what I learned from my Pullman career is when you put together, you see what the city looks like. You look across the factory. And you see no railroad car. Same story. Okay, how do you get a railroad car? How do you get the city to look better? Somebody has an idea, I'll call it a drawing, of what the car is going to look like. He says, you need these parts, you need these people, you need this, you need this, you need a part, you need a screw, you need a screwdriver, you need a guy to put it together. You need the tool, the piece, and the fastener, and that's how you build a railroad car. Now, in the city, you need a house, you need a job, you need transportation, all that stuff. It flows, right? One way or the other. But the guy in the middle, they used to call him manufacturing engineer, he goes, here's how you do it. You take these two parts, you take this screw, you put those two together. Now you're starting. Then you put another piece together. Pretty soon, you got the side of a railroad car, or you weld it, or you do something. Now, if you're going to do that to a city, there's all the problems Chicago has. What comes first? I mean, if we were going to sit in a room and say, we're going to fix this town, and it's going to work for Akron or not work, or it's going to work for... You know, what's the place in Wisconsin that lost the plant? It might work for Peoria. What do you do first? I mean, what are the, in what sequence do you put this thing together so you're on a fast track to where instead of my nephew's place scrambling to make parts for the 10 people are left, there's 50 people left and their place has to double. And by the way, you need 10 of them just like them, and they're all hiring. How do you get from point A to point B? You need schools. You can rattle off the 10 things you need, but how do you start? Greg, what do you think?
Bottom up, like you said before.
You need the place to have the jobs.
Start with something that's, I don't know, maybe a little bit related to public utilities or something that helps just about everybody in the neighborhoods that are not doing well.
You like it, me being the capitalist guy, even though Jan accused me of being a socialist half the time. I'd like to do it in such a way where the government piece of it is minimal. Maybe you help get the first two or three factories there. Maybe it is a railroad car factory. Maybe it is something else where you maybe...
The incentives have to be right.
Yeah, but after that, I want everybody else remodeling the houses. I don't want the city doing that. I want to leave as much as I can open to other people and just let them do it. Let them put the buildings back together. Let them, you know, build.
Yeah, the government's job is to make the rules and incentives such that the people do the work. So,
well, they might have to light the fire a little
bit. So I would think that it would be mostly in education here. That's the biggest opportunity for improvement.
There's no doubt that's in the top three. I'm getting this weird idea that, John, that the first thing in has to beg, borrow, and steal a couple of manufacturers to come in here and but all of a sudden need people. I don't know, maybe that's not right. I don't know if you can start with the education, because where are you going to get the money? The money comes from having people working, right?
Well, you can do
grow the tax base and make the schools, you know, enviable places to go to. You know, people want to have their kids enrolled there, and it's not because they have to have them enrolled there, but it's a conscious choice that this is the best place for them. You know, in the regulatory community, you know, sort of climate we have right now, I just don't see any big city prepared to sort of clean the slate about how you attract a business that requires perhaps building, you know, some dirty, dusty things in the middle of otherwise, you know, somewhat genteel areas that people, you know, are going to be hostile to any kind of intrusion like this. But to make it possible to have, you know, a quick, you know, construction site chosen, developed, have the infrastructure there, and not be so overburdened with, you know, testing and regulating that the thing never gets off the ground. I mean, Chicago's got so many examples of grandiose plans that were doomed from the start because there was never any desire to clean up the process of doing these kind of enormous projects. And now you can't even do small projects anymore. So if you made it inviting for people to build a small factory to produce something that's needed, and something would be better to produce it here than to have to transport it, you know, hundreds of miles to some other destination, that would be a start. But you get workers who need, you know, places for their kids to go to school, and you got, you know, a desire to live in this neighborhood and to put down roots in it and to make it an attractive place, the schools would follow. This is traditionally how it happened. You had neighborhoods that got built up, and all of a sudden they realized they needed schools, and they had to go out and you know, develop them. And now we've got, you know, schools galore, most of which I think could probably, you know, benefit from half of them being closed down. But that's not going to happen in this, you know, time we live in either. But I'd like to see the regulatory stuff.
Well, Jan, when you say they need to be closed down, I mean, you're right in a certain thing. The only problem with stuff closing down is it's really hard to start something from scratch. Plus, in the rural areas, you have schools, you know, pretty far apart. How far did Hal say he used to go after school every day? But you also have busing systems that are very robust. You get kids from place to place. You shut down a school in the city, and all of a sudden the kid who used to walk three blocks has to walk 3 miles. You got to find another way to get them there, right? And we don't have anything like that, do we?
Yeah, well, but we've got a school system that's designed for, you know, 3 million citizens.
You're coming in and out, Jen. Somehow your voice.
Yeah, I'm getting a little thing. It's an unstable connection. I'm not sure what's happening here.
The people on the left are shutting you up. they're listening to Carl, and they're listening to you, the government.
The thing is, you know, I'd be all for keeping all the schools, you know, possible open if they were the institution, kind of institution that made, you know, some kind of inroads into what the schools should be doing. And if you had, you know, turning out people who were productive workers and had basic skills, whether in shop class or home ec or anything else, so that they could get the ground running and get a job. But that isn't the kind of system we have. And we don't need multiple understaffed and underpopulated schools not doing their job. So if you had a system that was half as big as far as physical plants, and then you decided now we wanted to grow the city, and we need, you know, people to come in and start paying the tax bills and build stuff, the schools would follow again, just as we have with police stations. I mean, how many police stations over the years got closed down when it was decided, oh, we don't need this police station anymore? And then 5 or 10 years later, oh my God, we need this police station activated again, because we got a lot of stuff going on here. I mean, that was the case in Beverly and Morgan Park for years, you know, and people were
it's actually kind of nice if you decide the neighborhood's so safe you don't need the station. It's not necessarily a positive to reopen it.
Well, and that was the case for years. And Beverly was part of the Gresham Police Station, which, you know, in former times was kind of a sleepy place because there wasn't a lot of crime.
Yeah, but the police station was also about the size of our office.
Right. And these things were like shacks. There's one up by me. It's now, was a Thai restaurant for a while. Not a particularly big Thai restaurant, but it was the 17th District headquarters.
Well, here's kind of what I would...
If the demand was there, for,
you know, John, I think the demand, if we decided our education is for everybody, okay, we seem to have, if you decide, and we'll talk a bit more about this with Nancy, although Nancy has some interesting stories about people without insurance in Florida. If we decide we actually want to make a move forward in this city, and if we do something like really stupid in COVID where you start have people, I was talking to my buddy Kendall the other night, and his girlfriend works, fiance, said she says just about everybody in fifth grade now is second grade reading at best. Okay, so if you're going to, quote, get away with that, you need to have some way, if you expect your population to be able to work and have a job and make some money on their own, somehow you got to, I would open up, if it was me, you know, the difference between, I won't say people who trade for themselves and other people, John, is if you find a stock, if you find a position that you think looks good and it's a good idea, you do it and you monitor the hell out of it. And if it looks like it's not good for a second, you change it into something else, because things always change, right? But you can't be afraid to initiate the first transaction and have confidence in yourself that you will somehow do the best you can along the way to adjust it if it turns out what you thought was good didn't turn out so hot. It's not about, I mean, you know, even a monkey can have either a crummy position or a good position. It's the ones in between that it should be a loser that you get back to break even. That's where the science is. And it's very hard for somebody like me to explain that to somebody in a business they don't understand that much. But what I would do, I would pick two schools, maybe three, depending on how geographic diverse they are. And they're probably in total disrepair. I'll bet Tilden's one of them, CVS might be one of them, and we'll pick one on the west side. I would immediately go to an 18-hour operation in these places to where, you know, get the welding places back together, get the electrician place back together, get, you know, the plasterboard and whatever carpentry thing back together, and have classes at night in auto repair and those kinds of things, and during the day. And I would have no problem with adults signing up at night. Now, if there's some minor fee or something, fine, maybe it shouldn't be free, but maybe it's, you know, not restrictive either. It issues certificates to where somebody knows how to read a drawing after 6 months or whatever. A lot of the stuff like Kevin is doing in Indiana. And I'd have a little, some reading and some math classes there that were basic. And at 3 o'clock, it's all adults. Or it's people who graduated grammar school, but guess what? They still don't know how to read, they need to learn. Let's have a few places. Put up some dough. It's not like we're not spending the money anyway. Let's put up some dough. Let's get it together. Let's try it. If it's a total dud after 3-4 years, my grandfather told me from age 5 on, Tom, somebody who tries and fails is way better than somebody who never tried at all. I have no fear about trying this stuff. These other people, all they do is talk, Jen. It doesn't matter which side of the aisle they are. All they do is talk. I'm so tired of listening to them. They don't do anything.
Yep. We got enough physical space not being utilized in schools, Tom, they could be turned into boarding schools.
Without a doubt.
You know, I hate calling them like workhouses, But we're already like paying for feeding students.
That's what I'm saying. We're already paying for it.
And if the problem that the teachers' union identifies that all these, students come from families where everything is so uncertain and there isn't affordable housing, well, let's house the students then too while we're at it.
Well, I mean, even if you look at the immigration issue, and I don't want to get into the whole story about how many people are here, how many people should be here, what political parties. The simple fact is, you got 200 people. They're here. Looks to me like they're all hanging out in the Home Depot parking lot looking for a job. Why don't we put them over to this school, get them a certificate in carpentry in 3 months, so maybe they can go get a job. Once they're here, let's just accept it. Whether it should be 50 or 100 or they shouldn't be here at all, in my mind, John, we're past that. We got an empty building. We got empty rooms that used to teach people this stuff, and we're not doing anything. Well, why don't we just do it? And, oh, by the way, we'll stop other people from coming in, too. I'm not disagreeing with you on that. But let's do something instead of just bitch and moan about it.
Well, what we need to do is break the monopoly that public education has become. Because one thing that still makes for academic achievement, even in, especially in higher ed these days, is competition. Well, and it's not like there's not qualified teachers around somewhere.
All right, John, but when you say that, nobody likes competition more than me. But how is it that in our lifetime, the Chicago Public Schools used to do all of this and did a nice job? I mean, now they don't. When Audrey's on next week, we'll pin her down for 10 minutes and tell her about her experience at Kelly High School, which was a huge high school. Audrey will give you the whole story about how there's kids in college prep, there's kids learning electric, the place was everything for everybody. And all of a sudden, it's nothing for nobody. I like the idea of the competitive, but it's not like government shouldn't be able to do anything. When I was in the school, all the janitors, guess what? We cleaned the place every day. It was spotless. But now all of a sudden, we got to have outside people, this and that, and all these big contracts. What's the matter with hiring 2-3 guys to clean the place every night? This is not that difficult to mop a classroom floor, is it? I didn't find it that way. Why have we made this into a science fair project?
Well, I think I'll grant that at one time the Chicago Public Schools, I wouldn't say they never really had, I don't think, the edge over private schools or the Catholic school system when it came to performance, but they were clearly better run. They had better principals.
But no Catholic schools ever had shop class or anything like that I know of.
No, and that was not their. They didn't see that really as their mission,
right?
And if you wanted that, those classes were available. But they did teach. They had 2-year high school programs. That's what my mother went through, where she learned business English, shorthand, stenography, all this stuff. So that she could go out and get a clerical job after 2 years of high school. That's all she ever completed. But she said in later years, I think I was better prepared at having 2 years at St. Casimir's on the south side than if I'd gone 4 years to Gage Park, because they didn't have any kind of focus like that. So she got intense training by these the Lithuanian nuns who were destroyed.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
But she learned.
I bet they had rulers and erasers they wung at you.
Yeah, but in 2 years, at 16, she was out, and she got, decent jobs. So I just think that the kind of competition where, the Catholic schools always had the luxury where they could expel you if you weren't, paying your tuition.
Well, we got a dash. I remember taking woodshop at the Park District. I bet nobody does that anymore.
Right. But, the public schools had to keep you. People did get expelled, but that was not what they were in the business of educating people, was to expel them. But the systems had a very uneasy relationship.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Catholic schools were almost as big as the public schools back then. Hey, we got to go to break. Think up some questions for Nancy. SP Futures down 13, NASDAQ Futures down 59. What do you do if your place got knocked down in Florida and you have no insurance? Ugh. Be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Harrell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Individuals and businesses with tax problems, listen carefully. Do you feel like you're losing control of your finances? If you owe over $10,000 in back taxes or have unfiled tax returns, we can help you take back control. The IRS is the largest and most aggressive collection agency in the world, and they can seize your bank accounts, garnish your paycheck, close your business, and file criminal charges. Take control of your tax problem now by calling the experts at U.S. Tax Shield and take advantage of the Fresh Start program and new laws that allow us to negotiate a settlement for the lowest amount possible. Our Better Business Bureau A-rated team of tax attorneys and enrolled agents can stop collections and get you protected so you can take control of your financial future. Call now for a free case review and a low price guaranteed quote to get you protected today. Call now, 800-388-4901. That's 800-388-4901. U.S. Tax Shield, 800-388-4901.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Well, everyone, back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. Matt Byrne on the board. We'll do a quick traffic weather sports here because we've got to get to Nancy. NASDAQ futures down 55. S&P futures down 12. Europe's down some. Actually, probably more than a little, than a sum here. And Asia's down. Asia is the fun today. My machine is... There we go. DAX down 155.8%. FTSE down 52.6%. Here's the big mover, though. CAC around down 135, 1.7%. Auto stocks getting whacked down. They're all down like 4% over there. Over in Asia, again, this is the crazy. Nikkei down 1,900. That's almost 5%. That's huge. Hang Seng, however, is up 500, 2.4%. Shanghai is up 248. That's 8%. I'm saying that it's not the market going up. It's their currency going down, but that was only one guy talking. Oil up 3 cents, 68.21. We've got gold down 870 after a big strong week, but still 26.59, and we've got foreign exchange pretty much unchanged. Dollar's down a little weaker, maybe. We got crypto is down 3%, 2,034 to 63,871. That was pretty brief. Matt, let's give it a brief traffic weather sports, and we'll get to Nancy because she's got a lot of stuff to tell us today.
Yeah, sounds good. It's currently 61 degrees here in Chicago, high of 79 today, mostly sunny skies with little cloud coverage tonight. Cloudy with a low of 60. In Phoenix, 84 degrees right now. Later in the day, mostly sunny and very hot with a high of 107. In the MLB yesterday, we saw the White Sox win against Detroit. That was 9-5. Cubs lost against Cincinnati Reds, 3-0. And in the NFL, Bears won their second game of the season against the Rams. Final score was 24-18. And Packers lost to the Vikings, 31-29. So I got, Chief. Over to you.
Nancy, you with us?
I'm with you.
How are you? We got 15 different topics for you today. I guess the one is, what's everybody says mortgage The mortgages are flying out the door with the new rates. What's the real story there? The other one is, what the hell's going on in Florida? I got a buddy down there who had a place that got wrecked in the hurricane 2 years ago, and now it's wrecked again. I don't know if it was even quite finished being redone. But this thing hit like the exact same spot as a couple years ago. Are there people caught there without insurance? How do you have a mortgage without insurance? We all kind of, where do you want to start? Just rattle off all the answers to all these questions.
The first question, the mortgages, there's more interest in people trying to move or refinance to get rid of debt. So there's more interest. It doesn't necessarily mean that they can do it. So I don't know if they're flying out the door, but things are much better than what they were. I mean, before it was kind of dead. Now at least it's you know, moving or simmering. The insurance, I got a call on Friday from someone who had a home, she said, right on the right close to the harbor, and they would not renew her insurance. She's a snowbird. She said she kept trying to buy insurance, and now she left and came back up here, and it hit, and her house is gone.
So what does that mean?
Well, the question becomes, I mean, like she said, do I still have to pay on my mortgage? What do I do? Because I had no insurance. And I said, well, when you have a mortgage, you sign a paper that you always keep it insured until it's paid off. So the only thing I can think of to do in a situation like that is for her to call FEMA. Because if you are in a flood zone, which I would imagine if you're close to a marina, you have to at least have flood insurance. And so I know Florida, a lot of insurance companies have pulled out, and I heard it's very difficult to get insurance down there. I do believe that people are uninsured because of that reason. I know in that fire in Hawaii, remember when it, you know, took that whole section out? None of those people had insurance. They inherit their homes from their parents, and, you know, none of those people really have insurance. So that whole situation was a mess in Hawaii. Still is. That's why they're trying to raise money to get these homes rebuilt. Now, in Florida, I have no idea. I mean, you have to have insurance if you have a mortgage. So did the mortgage company know and force place insurance?
Well, let's take it.
She wants to know if she still owes the money. I'm sure she still owes the money.
Well, some states, a mortgage isn't a personal debt. I assume Florida is not one of those states.
A mortgage is a personal debt?
California was not a personal debt. I don't know if that's changed.
I mean, a mortgage is the they take the house for collateral, but now the house is gone. But
I'm saying in California, if you walked away from a mortgage loan 20 years ago, you just walked away. It was not on your. You didn't have to declare bankruptcy.
Well, I'm thinking that
might have changed. But John, pile in here if your connection is still good. Let's say, for instance, I've owned a house a couple times. I buy a house. I get my mortgage from Nancy or whoever, hopefully from Nancy. Part of the deal is I got to pay my taxes. Oh, by the way, and I got to have insurance. All right, so I have the insurance, and a year later, there's 3 windstorms in Chicago, and all of a sudden, nobody sells me insurance. I don't have it anymore. Now what do I do? I can't get it. So does that mean it can't mean my loan's no good? It can't mean now. What do we do? I guess is my question.
Well, the typical mortgage language for a covenant, say an insurance, and also, you know, a covenant, you know, to keep the property habitable and, you know, not in violation of local zoning or housing standards. So if you get a building violation suit, you're in violation of a mortgage covenant. Same thing with not insuring the property, but it accelerates the loan. You know, at least that's the typical enforcement, such that if it's discovered that you have broken one of these covenants, your entire mortgage balance is due and owing, and you have to refinance.
Well, but if a whole area, all of a sudden you can't get insurance, good luck with that.
Yeah, I mean, then it's going to be the lender's, you know, call what to do. I mean, if they give you a grace period to try to cure this breach and not accelerate the loan, especially if they've got lots of people in the same boat in the same area who are also in violation. The lender isn't going to get, you know, very far. If you can't refinance your loan, then you're going to walk on it. Then the lender's left holding the bag. That's the last thing they want, too. But, you know, if it happens in great enough numbers, the lender could give you a grace period to reinstate, you know, your good standing by getting insurance somehow. But the signals I'm getting from California people and Florida people, you just can't get the insurance. The companies are leaving. So I don't know. It's going to have to be a kind of industry solution by the lenders to figure out how they're going to cope with that. And I just think that's going to discourage, you know, investment and, you know, mortgage lending in all these states.
I'd say it'll discourage it a lot. Nance, how about walking us through just an education? You can be our fourth grade teacher. I didn't like my fourth grade teacher. She made me diagram 10 sentences. All right, but you're my fifth grade teacher. When you talk about flood insurance in Illinois, I mean, and I've learned this much from Audrey, and by the way, I did my real estate license about 40 years ago, that somebody somewhere has a map of Illinois with all the, I'll use the term, 100-year storms or 40-year storms, and where this stream has gone to, this river has gone to. And if you're in that area, the home needs flood insurance. And a lot of times you don't get that from insurance company. It's a separate thing through FEMA. Am I correct? Kick me if I'm wrong.
FEMA gives you what is in a floodplain. None of Chicago is in a floodplain, so.
But some of the suburbs are.
Yeah.
I mean, it might be the guy across the street is, and you're 100 feet further from the creek and 5 feet higher, and you're not, right? I mean, it's that.
Correct. So part of your property could be in a floodplain, and another part could not.
So, okay, so then do I get that insurance from State Farm or Allstate, or do I get that from somebody else?
It's a separate policy, FEMA demands that you, if you have flood insurance, if you're in a floodplain and you have a mortgage, you have to get flood insurance. There's no way out.
So, you get it from the government or you get it from your insurance company?
You get it from the insurance company.
Okay.
See, the problem is when people are saying they can't get insurance, this is another fine line here. They're saying they can't afford what it's going to cost. So the mortgage company can force place it and then just keep adding it to your bill.
Well, but if there's, you know, two or three floods in an area that aren't supposed to have one for 50 years, it could be nobody wants to give one in that spot, right? I mean, isn't that what happened to, I'm skipping around here, but you get this flood insurance. Now, that doesn't necessarily include water in your basement. It includes, you're talking about floods from the creek or the river, right?
No.
Right.
No, guys. If you get water in your basement and it, your homeowner's policy covers that up to $5,000. But if you're in a floodplain and it has anything to do with just being too low, the flood insurance policy could kick in.
Okay, because I know the guys in the city, when you have your sewers backed up and you flooded that way, your flood insurance didn't cover that.
You don't have flood insurance in the city. None of Chicago is in a floodplain. Okay. If you're not in a floodplain, you can't get flood insurance. So the city of Chicago absolutely makes sure they are not in a floodplain. So, like, when everyone flushes their toilet, like in Mount Greenwood, and then they get water, there's a $5,000 rider on their policy, and that's all they get because they are not in a floodplain and they are not allowed to get flood insurance.
Even if it, well, I guess, now in Houston, when they had that massive rainstorm, they had all that damage. Didn't a lot of the homes that, quote, flooded, that area had never flooded before, so that was not considered a floodplain, right?
Right.
If it's not considered a floodplain, you cannot get flood insurance.
But so you couldn't, even if you were across the street, like your side of the street's a floodplain and mine isn't across the street, I could sit there and go, you know, these rainstorms are getting a little worse. I want to get flood insurance even though I'm not in a floodplain. I can't do it.
Cannot do it.
No insurance company will give it to you, even if you pay for it.
It doesn't matter. It's not office. It's not how it works. You have to be in a floodplain to get flood insurance. And then you have to get, like, sewer. You can get sewer backup insurance. You can get sewer breaking insurance. But no, you're not going to be covered.
So those people in Houston, if it's now reclassified as yet, could be a floodplain. Now they can get insurance after they didn't have it and the house is gone. That's kind of a, that doesn't help much.
Yeah, they've got new data now to redraw the boundaries.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the FEMA is constantly changing the floodplain.
Yeah.
Really?
Yes. Like on, I think it was the Friday before last, FEMA declared parts of Cook County, Will County, parts of DuPage, a disaster area. So now every mortgage has stopped being closed if you're in those areas, and we have to have it took me a week to figure out what the cure is, and the cure is that the appraiser has to go back out and look at everything, and then it's $175 to the homeowner, you know, financing or buying or whatever, to make sure that that property is still in a still good, free of water,
really
free of damage. Yes. So there's different rules. FEMA just strictly decides who's in a floodplain. If you're in a floodplain, you got to get insurance. If you have a mortgage, if you don't have a mortgage, you don't have to worry about it.
Well, this massive flooding that went in North Carolina. I mean, there's no way you guys would know this exactly, but your opinion's probably better than mine. We're talking about monumental floods in North Carolina from this hurricane, even though it was hundreds of miles from the center of the thing. Do you think those people were in floodplains or not?
I don't think that's considered a flood. I think that's considered a natural disaster, and I think that would be covered.
But if it, this is the part
on regular policy. On your regular policy, I think it would be covered.
Because I think when we used to get together once in a while, Nance, I think I told you a story. My buddy of mine who shared a spot with me in the OEX. It's another story. I'll leave for another day. His parents had a place on the Redneck Riviera. Biloxi, and they were across the street, and they had whatever insurance you needed, right? They had one of the hurricanes hit, like, right there. And they went down there, and the entire condominium building is gone, right? Like, okay. He says to me, hey, where's my parents' dresser? I go, Ron, I have no idea, but must be in the swamp someplace. Nobody found anything of anybody's. It's just gone. Well, it took them years before they got, like, 40 cents on the buck, because insurance company said it was a storm surge, not the wind, or one or the other. But the place is totally evacuated, so nobody knew if it was the wind or the storm surge or both. The insurance company just fought the hell out of them, and they never rebuilt or anything. They just got like 40% on the buck, and we're going. Randy said the thing was just a slab. You'd never even know there was a building there. It was just gone. I mean, how does somebody determine if you're in North Carolina and all of a sudden you get all this rain? You get flooded, but some other guy's closer to the river. The river's higher than it's ever been, and he gets flooded. Now, if you're across the street where you had it flooded before, now you get covered. If you're in the street, the part where it's the first time it ever flooded, you don't get covered. Is this as complicated as I'm reading here, or no?
No. I mean, you have to look at the floodplains. You're either in or out, and they get to decide. A storm has nothing to do with change. Just because you flooded doesn't mean they change the floodplain. I know there was a storm in Tinley Park about, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago.
I remember that, yeah.
Okay, and it ran like, you know, west to east or east to west, and there was a whole line of these homes that were completely flooded. I mean, I walked in one, and water was up to the first floor. The basement was completely gone, and those people were told, you're getting your $5,000, and that's it.
Wasn't that Tinley Creek that went to like 20 feet deep or something?
I don't know. I know the section I'm talking about, but I don't know the details surrounding it. But I know this Mayor Zabracki in Tinley went to the insurance companies and said, look, we're going to send out engineers to figure out why it flooded the way it flooded. Okay, because it was like two homes all the way from east to west that got it. Everybody else around them didn't get it at all. Okay, and they redesigned it, and they made, you know, those things you see where they're retention ponds. They actually made them, and they actually made them for them. And then somehow he cut a deal with the insurance companies that they paid. But see, this is what I'm talking about. You don't really know what you have to go to use it, and just because someone turned you down doesn't mean you can't buy the insurance at a ridiculous price, but they keep looking for what they had before, and you have then really what you should have done was sold the place and moved somewhere else, right? Or paid the ridiculous price. But doing nothing is a decision in itself.
Well, Nancy, like, places, when you say the insurance of places in Florida, Jan, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, don't some of the big companies, I use Allstate, you know,
they're pulling out.
But they, yep. but even before that, didn't they have subs that were working down there that if the number got too big, the sub just went out of business and didn't impact the big company? What if somebody, there's so many claims against the insurance company, they can't pay? Now what? Now what do you do?
Well, I think, you know, the state insurance, you know, examiners, the licensing has, I believe, a reserve fund that's of a certain amount in the case that an insurance company becomes insolvent and they've got outstanding, you know, policyholders' claims, so that it becomes then a state bailout pretty much. And or right. And if it's big enough, that was, you know, you look for federal money too.
Yeah, I mean, I told the woman to try and call FEMA and see what they can do for her. You know, the other thing I'm wondering, was this a not a stick-built house, but a, you know, house, a manufactured house that was just placed there? You know what I mean? Where it doesn't really have a foundation?
Well, Dan Janitas had, his place got affected. The big Florida one, was it last year, Jen, or year before? And he said that the people who got hurt there years and years, anything that was actually to code, the new hurricane codes, the codes worked really well. And a lot of the people who were, you know, you don't have, the sides are rounded, and there's all kinds of stuff to it, right, Jen? Where when you build it and the roof's different. He said a lot of those places did very well, and there wasn't that much damage. So if they find out afterward that your house was not built to code, is there any redress to the builder or anything like that, Nance, or everybody forgets about all that?
I don't think I think by then the builder's out of it. I think people have to be responsible for what they own. And then, perfect example, in Illinois, no one pays for earthquake insurance, right? But if there is an earthquake in Illinois and we're in some kind of fault.
Yeah, it's the biggest earthquake ever in this country was in Illinois.
I know. That's exactly why no one has the insurance. That's exactly why no one has the insurance. Exactly. Right there. No one has the insurance. So, but if there's an earthquake, God forbid, nobody's got it.
You know, here's an assignment for Mr. Flanagan, because he's so good at this. way back in Dud Day, John, I was flying, I don't know what I was doing, a business trip for somebody way the hell back when Midway Airlines was still around.
Oh, yeah.
And the magazine that they would put in the little thing in front of you so you could read it on the way was Chicago Magazine. Is that still around, or are they toast?
Chicago Magazine's still around.
They had an article on the thing that had to be 25, 30 pages long regarding earthquakes. History of earthquakes in this country, different types of buildings that go up and what buildings that would hang in there and those that wouldn't. It had to do with Chicago architecture, and it had to do with the... You know, there's a fault on the East River in New York? It never moves, but it could. It's right in the East River. There's a fault. But the fault here in Illinois... It was the New Madrid Fault. That's the one you're talking about, Nance. Most of the time it's a shift along a fault, but this one isn't like that. It actually shifted. Did it shift down, John, or up?
Subduction, yeah.
It went up or down, and not along. So it all has to do is if you're in the mountains, if you have an earthquake in San Francisco, it's bad, but the mountains kind of block it from going too far. This one, the earthquake that was here, it went, say it was a 7.5 on a Richter scale, it was still like a 6.5 in Pennsylvania. It just kept going, and it stopped bells, clocks in Boston. But it actually, what, the Mississippi River went backwards for a while?
And then it was absolutely, and they were talking about all the buildings in Chicago. I don't know how you got me off on this, Nance. Your fault. They went right down the list. A building like mine, toast. Totally toast. It's the old brick up and down. There's no lateral stability. When you see a house going up now in the with the two layers of brick, see that little piece of, like, it looks like aluminum foil. It gets out of one brick and goes up and into the brick next to it. It's aluminum, but it's a piece of metal. That's earthquake protection. I didn't know that until I read this article. It gives that wall lateral stability. Bet you knew that, Chad, didn't you?
Well, they had it in Chicago buildings for wind bracing, because wind was, especially in a really tall building. But I have it even in my two flat here. I got these rods that go through the building below my floor on the second floor. And on either side, they have ties that hold them in place. So the building still shakes on a windy day, let me tell you.
Well, the buildings, your Sears Tower, your First National Bank, whatever the building is now, those buildings are tied into the bedrock. They'll shake the hell out of you, but they'd still be okay. The ones that are built on caissons, maybe not so much, Jen. They might go down.
Look, they float, really.
Yeah, they could blow. Nance, is more than you wanted to hear, eh?
No, I mean, it's an interesting subject, but people don't understand, like, that floodplains, you know, flood insurance go with floodplains. And then, like, in Asheville, North Carolina, didn't the dam break?
Something crazy happened down there. But, I mean, it way more damage than a hurricane that didn't come near the place.
Go ahead.
I'm saying, hey, before you go, we'll run a minute or two over because you and John together are always so good. Who should be, other than somebody who has a massive credit card debt that wants to get on their mortgage, with the rates where they are, who should legitimately be calling you? Somebody who's got a 7.5, 7.6 mortgage?
Yeah, I mean, if they want to drop like 1% or, you know, I found an open bond the other day for 5.625. You might get lucky, might not. What's the worst thing that can happen? You just give it a call, and if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't, right? Because they have to make up their mind.
If you get 5.7, it's worth it to come down from anybody who's 7.2 or higher. Didn't you always say a point and a half?
Yeah, I mean, it's worth it, especially if you owe a lot of money. A $100,000 mortgage, I don't think it's going to make that big of a difference, but anything higher than that. If you got a $300,000 mortgage, I mean, 1% is going to really be a lot to go down. It is. You're married to your house. You're not married to the rate.
Well, give us a shameless plug. What's your phone number?
708-341-9601. I can't believe our half hour is up. I feel like we just got into a good conversation here, guys.
We're going to have to bring you on a few minutes earlier, I think, from now on. What do you think, Jen?
Yep, I gotta shut up for a couple more minutes, I think.
Well, I mean, we don't need to argue. We can argue politics after the election, but in the meantime, let's talk about something real. Because if we get somebody helped out with the mortgage stuff, I just hope our buddy from Notre Dame had insurance on his reconstruction on his place, John. One of our friends, Nance, Odd's met him a bunch of times. He had a place down there that got whacked with the hurricane, was it 2 years ago? Same spot. Now they had the place almost fixed, and it got whacked again. How's that for luck?
Yeah, well, they're going to do something for them. It's just, you just got to figure out what. I mean, I know someone who lives in really down, Marco Island, and his house wasn't affected by the hurricane at all. I mean, the one that really went through Marco, because everything is hurricane proof.
Well, that's what hurricane the engineers are saying, is if you're up to code, but he said it doesn't stop you from the guy next door's house being decimated or the guy's boat ended up on your roof, that type of thing. He said somebody's sailboat was in the... Did he say, Jen, that somebody's sailboat was in the pool next door?
Yes, yeah.
And it's still there. It still hasn't moved, is it?
Yeah. Unbelievable.
It's crazy stuff. I told you... I don't know if I told you this, Nance. My buddy Bill, his brother or somebody down there, his in-laws, they were down where the one hit, you know, 2 years ago. That's where all the Irish people in the Midwest are. That's why we heard so much about it. Whoever this guy was takes his two cars and takes them inland. Well, the thing was so in some warehouse there that was supposedly protected.
the cars are gone. So is the warehouse. Somewhere in the middle of the swamp, there's some alligator in a Corvette, basically. They never found them. They're just gone out in the swamp someplace. Unless somebody did get them, who the hell knows?
I do wonder what happens to the alligators. I mean, I really do. You know, because they're in like these ponds and these restricted communities and stuff, you know. And I mean, do they get swept out of the water? Do they get hit by debris? What happens to these guys?
A lot of them get relocated.
That's what I would think, you know. They just get moved somewhere else. But wow,
it's just hard to tell. It's hard to tell one from the other. You don't know if a jury alligator or a new guy. How would you know?
the 30 foot one I've been seeing all my life, or is there?
I just don't. You know what? I don't.
We'll buy new ones.
You're not going to get me to fly anywhere where they got mosquitoes, humidity, and alligators. I'm sorry. Just not me.
You're going to fly, Tom.
I mean, I saw a couple of those guys in Florida. I was down there, and I'm like, you know, I'm not going to hit my ball. Well, didn't stop me from hitting a ball in the water. It stopped me from going after it. That's for sure. Nancy, thank you.
Yeah, I wouldn't go after the ball in the water in Florida either.
S&P futures down 12, NASDAQ futures down 44. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Well, I woke up Sunday morning with no way to hold my head. Didn't hurt. And the beer I had for breakfast wasn't bad, so I had one more for dessert.